Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Hello. Today we'll be discussing the politics of criminal justice in England and Wales. Why are we an outlier amongst liberal democracies in seeking ever tougher justice? I'm joined by my co-host Rob Allen and by Rory Stewart, a former prisons minister and co-presenter of the Rest is Politics podcast, and Stephen Bush, associate editor at the Financial Times. Rob, the recent King's speech was full of red meat for supporters of tougher justice. Is it good policy?
Well, certainly the worst offenders will spend longer in prison, but thankfully they're relatively small in number. Many more people will be affected by plans to suspend short prison sentences and release people earlier, measures which have been forced on the government by simply running out of prison space.
Rory, going back to your experience, you became prisons minister, having hardly ever been in a prison in England and Wales. Do you think most politicians understand enough about how the criminal justice system actually works?
No, but remember, of course, that prisons are just like every other department in that respect. Our defence secretaries don't know anything about the military. Our health secretaries don't know anything about the NHS. Our education secretaries have usually not been teachers. That's the British political system. Ministers are reshuffled. Ministers are amateurs. They're drawn from a very, very small gene pool. They have to be drawn from members of parliament. And actually, very, very few people in parliament have spent much time in prisons. It's one of the problems with prisons. Unlike a hospital or a school, where you're very likely to have a child or a relative in a hospital or a school, prison is something that operates almost as an island in society, and its contact to many people outside very particular social groups is very limited.
It's true. It's true. So looking back, what most shocked you about the system?
I think what most shocked me is how disgracefully filthy, violent, drug-ridden prisons were, how neglected they were. You know, I went to Liverpool Prison within my first week and found every window broken on the first landing I walked into, the toilets cracked, the call bells disabled, just a sense of really shameful conditions, which would have made the Victorians who built those prisons ashamed. I mean, those prisons were smarter, neater, better maintained, and less crowded during the Victorian period than they are today.
We've had some research done recently through an organisation called Better Justice, and they've been interviewing ex-ministers and special advisors about criminal justice policy, and a lot of them have said that being assigned a ministerial post in the Ministry of Justice, sorry about this, Rory, is seen by many as a kind of a hospital pass. Why do you think within government, justice is so lacking in political status? Stephen?
I think it's a combination of things. The biggest part is simply about money. You know, the Ministry of Justice doesn't have any of the politically powerful bits of the criminal justice brief anymore. You know, if you're the Secretary of State or the Justice Minister and you're trying to get more money into your department, and the various media and political levers you can pull to try and embarrass Downing Street and the Treasury into giving you more money that most voters care about, actually almost all of them are now located in the Home Office. So I think it's partly that lack of internal power and prestige, but I think it's also there is a broader political trend, I would say, that forces MPs to be much more like super councillors, to be much more focused on what goes on in their own constituencies. And for all of the reasons Rory was just setting out there about how most politicians don't come into contact with prisons in the way they do come into contact with schools and hospitals, most of their constituents don't come into contact with prisons or indeed with the criminal justice system more broadly. There isn't really an electoral dividend for being the "I am the person who really cares about local courts falling down" politician. And it actually, even within the traditionally liberal base of the Labour Party, there is not a large group of people in your CLP, if you're a justice minister, who are going, thank goodness someone's doing something about prison conditions.
I would say, on the point of does it affect people, I think it is a bit of a hidden issue because one in six people in England and Wales has a criminal record. So actually, one in six have had contact in their lives involving some kind of criminal sanction.
I mean, Rory, when you were prison minister, you set out to try and improve the conditions you've talked about, the terrible conditions, and you started with 10 prisons. What did your colleagues think of that initiative? Did they admire what you were trying to do, or did they sort of see it as a bit of an eccentric pet project?
I think Stephen's right in saying that it's not the kind of project which traditionally would be appealing to ambitious conservative ministers. So trying to make prisons less violent, which was my basic focus, is not something that polls well. It's not something that was likely to achieve headlines. It didn't involve legislation. So it didn't involve any of the kind of things that traditionally would excite a lot of the leading figures at the time. So if I'd been working for Boris Johnson or Liz Truss or Priti Patel, all of whom I worked for in other departments, they would have told me to shut up and forget it. But I was very fortunate in having David Gawke as a boss, who is a very thoughtful person who sat down, listened, took seriously the fact that I said prisons were a mess, and was prepared to let me have a go at improving them, regardless of the politics of it. And I think that was true of his tenure in general. I mean, that was also true when we effectively renationalized probation or took Birmingham Prison back from the private sector into the public sector. These are all things which most conservative secretaries of state before us would have shied away from doing. It was the same with abolishing short prison sentences.
I mean, Stephen, I don't know if you heard last week at the COVID inquiry, a senior official, Helen McNamara, said that when Number 10 were discussing what to do about prisoners, aware that there was a huge risk of a big spread of the virus within it, they were particularly concerned about a potential media backlash if they decided to release a lot of prisoners. Did that surprise you, that they were concerned about that?
No. I think what we saw in the COVID inquiry is in many ways the least unusual thing the government did during the pandemic. We were obviously uniquely unlucky to have a prime minister, a chief advisor, a permanent secretary, who in different ways were all deeply unsuited to those roles. But actually, the reaction on prisons, I think, would probably have happened under almost every government of my lifetime. In microcosm, right, that is the story of why prisons in England and Wales are in a bad state. Essentially, at the point something starts to go wrong when you can fix it fairly quickly, only a relatively small tranche of Liberal voters and people who are directly involved in the criminal justice system will notice or care. And there are always favourable headlines to be won by going, no, yeah, we're not going to release anyone early. You know, whether it's the pandemic or prison places or what happens in prisons to turn people's lives around, it's only when you have to turn around and go, oh, well, because we didn't fix this problem downstream, we actually can't deliver the thing you'd like, that the kind of authoritarian majority of British voters care.
Well, that's an interesting point. Rory, actually, other countries, including many US states, released a significant proportion of their prison population during COVID to stop, you know, COVID going rife within prisons. We instead decided not really to do any early release. We did about two people. And we locked up our prisoners for 23 hours a day instead. Are we a less humane country or just more risk averse?
I don't think we're a less humane country than the United States when it comes to incarceration and prisons. It's not a simple binary thing. I think there are things that can be quite good about the US system. I think their supervision around suicide can be stronger than in the British system. But fundamentally, their prison system is unbelievably controlling and aggressive. I saw, for example, in Cook County Jail, prison officers saying very, very bluntly and brutally to me, these people are not my friends, these people are criminals, I'm going to treat them like criminals, which isn't stuff that you would normally hear in a British prison. So I wouldn't overdo the idea that the US is a much more humane system.
I would also add, I think the UK's response to prisons in the pandemic and the US's response to prisons in the pandemic has to be understood in the context of their broader pandemic response. Right, we shouldn't forget that in the first lockdown, the British state and police did spend money on drones to tell people not to go on walks and went on too long. Right, and I think one of the things which is quite fascinating about the UK sort of political mind is that we're a country which is much more socially liberal on personal freedom of religion, freedom of who you love, how you self-identify, than the average one of our peer countries. But we're also much more authoritarian. I mean, you know, when you poll on some lockdown measures now, you still get about a third of the country going, oh yeah, of course, nightclubs should still be closed. So I think in some ways, the reason why we were the outlier on how we acted in prisons at the start of the lockdown is also why we are the outlier on a bunch of other issues. Yeah, it's why I often use the term authoritarian as opposed to socially conservative, because I don't think it is quite right to say that the British electorate is socially conservative. But on everything where it's a kind of liberal authoritarian axis, there is something about the British political character that tends towards that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, taking a slightly longer term view, I mean, under Margaret Thatcher, for instance, the prison population stayed relatively low. She appointed relatively liberal Home Secretaries. Douglas Hurd is probably the best example. What do you think changed since then? Why have subsequent Conservative leaders found it so hard to maintain that approach?
Well, I think it is actually partly because the Thatcher government is in some ways the last unashamed socially conservative government we've had. I think the thing that the type of voter who liked having Suella Braverman or Priti Patel in the Home Office used to get under Margaret Thatcher was Section 28 and a bunch of rhetoric about single parents, single mothers in particular. And essentially, now that you could not say the stuff that socially conservative politicians in that period used to say and remain in public life, let alone in the front bench of either of those political parties. And I think what kind of happened in the 90s was that under Blair and Brown, it's kind of like, well, look, we're not going to meet the electorate where they are on LGBT rights, but you can instead have indefinite sentences. You can instead have all of these various repressions. And that's become the arena in which the votes of authoritarian voters are contested is law and order. So I think that's what's shifted since the Thatcher era.
Rory, there is that strand way back under Thatcher in the Conservative Party of being, you know, liberal, I don't know what word we want to use, sort of progressive about crime and justice. What's happened to that?
Well, I mean, I think Stephen's being very interesting about this, and it's something I would have to think about a great deal. It's interesting, as you say, that she appointed Willie Whitelaw and Douglas Hurd as her Home Secretaries, who were more on the wetter end of the party. I guess probably there's also a story around the decline of the what probably would be called the patrician tradition in the Conservative Party. In other words, there was a strong tradition still operating in the early 1980s of British men, many of whom had served in the Second World War, many of whom had inherited a sort of Macmillan-esque view of the world, which was they were a bit reluctant to engage in some of the kind of muscular aggressive language that John Redwood or Mrs. Thatcher others would be leaning into. And I think it's also about changes in social structures in Britain. I mean, I think the Willie Whitelaw was the MP for my constituency. He was my predecessor's predecessor. And I think he would have thought in an odd way, that it was slightly ungentlemanly to be being ferocious about people who'd committed crime. I think his instincts were more the sort of instincts he would have had as an army officer towards his soldiers, which is more sort of general sympathy and more a sense that there's something slightly embarrassing and unfitting about people sounding ferociously authoritarian.
Although he did introduce short, sharp shock detention centres for juveniles, I remember. So it was a sort of balanced approach.
Now, short, sharp shock, again, is quite military. I mean, I think the way that he viewed it would have been more the way that you'd deal with a soldier. I think he would have been sceptical about the idea of locking people up for incredibly long sentences. I mean, what Alex Chalk's now done, which is effectively to double the sentence for rapists, well, that seems to be the implication, saying that they won't be released at half time, is going to have a very profound effect on the system. If you double the sentence for rapists, your overcrowding problems become much, much greater, because many of the short sentence prisons are just in for a matter of days. And so you can put a lot of them through a prison. I mean, they're only occupying a room for 10 days. Whereas a rapist with a double sentence, you're taking out that room for 6 years, 18 years. Yeah.
I mean, most people agree that the change in the 90s came really between when Kenneth Clark was Home Secretary and was replaced by Michael Howard, and the Michael Howard prison works approach has kind of set the frame. I mean, Stephen, New Labour took the decision not to oppose that approach, indeed to go with it and if anything, take it further. Why do you think they did that? Was it purely electoral?
No, I think it was maybe a 50-50 proposition, if that, maybe actually even a 40-60 electoral, 60% belief. The Labour Party traditionally, on criminal justice in particular, has been less of a reliably liberalising force than the Conservative Party throughout quite a lot of the post-war period. And in many ways, although Tony Blair loved to play up this idea he was a breach with the past on every issue, you can draw a pretty direct line, I think, between his saying, yeah, well, I agree with Michael Howard, prison does work, and everything Jim Callaghan did, everything Mason did in response to the troubles in Northern Ireland. And I think it actually it partly reflects their distinct statist tradition. They do believe in this idea of, well, we can fix this problem because there's this big centralized thing where we send a bunch of people and we incarcerate them for a long time. And we shouldn't forget them, of course, like the last Labour government did give us, not just we'll incarcerate them for a long time, but we'll incarcerate them for a rolling indefinite time that we will decide without really having to consult anyone else.
IPPs.
Yeah, the IPPs. Right? And that I think, is baked very deeply into the Labour Party's traditions and the way it thinks about criminal justice and state power. And maybe actually one of the reasons why we've seen that shift in the Conservative Party is that we shouldn't forget that those 13 years of New Labour were the longest period basically in the history of the United Kingdom since, you know, the long 18th century that the Conservatives have been out of power. And that, of course, did change lots of people's fundamental assumptions about politics. One of them probably was it changed their fundamental assumptions in a way that was more illiberal on prison policy in particular.
Mm. I mean, just to bring that the story sort of up to date, Rory, there was a period in the Cameron government, before your time even, David Cameron made quite an interesting speech on prisons in about 2016 when he talked about the need for prison reform as a great social issue that he was going to take forward, and with Michael Gove, thought that more and more people in prison wasn't the answer. We needed much more constructive regimes and so on. That kind of fell flat, didn't it? Why did that not really run?
Well, it's very interesting. So you're absolutely right. He did that. And a lot of that is about his relationship with Michael Gove. And Michael Gove was very, very good whenever he had a brief of making it central to whichever prime minister he had. So he did the same with the environment, and Theresa May managed to insert it into one of her major planks. I think Cameron also, when Ken Clark was the Secretary of State back in sort of 2010 to 2012, also essentially promised Ken Clark that if he cut the number of prison officers and made sort of ferocious cuts to the Ministry of Justice budget, that he would support him in reducing the prison population, which was the only way that the logic was going to work. And the Treasury wanted to do that. Of course, it saves them money. But in practice, Cameron was always unable to resist the retail politics of sounding ferocious at the dispatch box and signaling that he was going to get behind, maybe not as many as Boris Johnson did, but this whole tradition, which you'll be aware of bills with the names of constituents attached, called things like Tony's Law or Charlotte's Law, which generally are an example of some horrible crime, horrible tragedy in a constituency, which is leading a member of parliament, could be from any party, to say we need to apply much, much longer or mandatory sentences for this particular type of crime. So yes, I think in the end, as with many things, Cameron never really had the political courage or maybe the motivation to follow through and make the difficult decisions, even if when making speeches or when chatting to Ken Clark, his instincts might have been to reduce the prison population. He wasn't really prepared to do it. If you're really prepared to do it, if you look at what Gawke tried to do, throughout our time, we weren't just trying to get rid of short prison sentences. we were also resisting any attempts to impose new prison sentences for new crimes. We were resisting the continual flurry of Conservative and Labour backbenchers coming in, demanding more and more ferocious sentences. We were also having to resist the polling people coming in saying, Theresa May is behind Labour on every single indicator except law and order. Please don't screw this up for us. This is the one thing we're trying to hold on to. And I just don't think Cameron cared enough to want to take the steps necessary. But maybe I'm being unfair. Maybe he did things that I'm not aware of.
I mean, you make a point there about public opinion, Rory, which obviously kind of looms above this whole debate. And a recent survey commissioned by the Justice Select Committee found that people wanted ever tougher sentences, maximum sentences for rape and domestic burglary. And we already have very high sentences for those. Do you actually think public opinion could be led in a different direction by brave politicians, or should they, to an extent, ignore it?
Well, I think with any controversial issue, it's a delicate balance between the two. So if you're doing something that's unpopular, you have to find a very, very powerful way of communicating it when you're talking about it. And you also have to be clever enough not to talk about it all the time. And there are many things like that in public life. I mean, it's not just true in prisons. For example, we probably need a foreign office that's twice the size of our current foreign office, and we need to have proper budgets for embassies. That's extremely unpopular. The Daily Mail does not like ambassadors having parties and drinking champagne, and they don't like the idea of wasting money on foreign affairs. I think the same was my experience in international development. You know, it was a very, very difficult sales job trying to convince people that there was anything useful in what we were doing. But I think the way that you do it is you communicate competence. So a lot of it is not about the details of policy. It's about the politician projecting in their public appearances that we've got a grip on this. We care about this. We care about quality. We care about detail. We're pragmatic people. We're doing the right stuff. You cut out programs that are obviously offensive to the public. You make the most of the arguments that you can. And to some extent, you stay out of the media.
I mean, Stephen, what do you think of the public opinion point? Is it something that's really limiting for political actors to do anything about?
Governments can and actually do all the time govern against public opinion, as Rory says, but they've kind of got to pick some issues to do that on and some issues to not. So I think the limiting factor is it's not an issue which lots of politicians have a particular inbuilt passion for, and therefore it's very easy for it to fall down the list of priorities. And also it becomes self-fulfilling, right? One of the reasons why people, I think, rightly do lean towards longer sentences for burglary, rape, murder, is that they are, of course, for very different reasons, crimes that leave people either with a permanent loss in the shape of the victim or a permanent sense of violation. You know, a very large number of people whose houses are broken into choose then to move house afterwards. And because our prison estate is in such a bad state, we are therefore really bad at rehabilitation. So really, actually, the one thing our prison system does well is keep people in there long enough for them to age out. The other thing, most crime is something perpetrated by young men. So if you have a bad prison system, actually, after a while, the evidence does start to go, well, actually, the one thing that the British state can do well in prison policy is just incarcerate young men until they're old men and therefore can't do crimes. And so you then end up chasing your own tail, because if you just come to it clean, what is the evidence that the British state can rehabilitate people other than just through locking them up for a long period? It's not very good.
Rory, do you think at the moment that both the administration and the opposition, at least in their rhetoric, have chosen this as an issue where they're going to lean into public opinion rather than try and kind of defy it in a way?
Yeah, I mean, you can see it with Keir Starmer's very controversial campaign against Rishi Sunak, where he said, you know, do you think that people who sexually assault children should be sent to prison? Rishi Sunak doesn't. And then it puts at the bottom of the thing, you know, whatever it is, 1,400 people who sexually assaulted children were not sent to prison last year. Now, this is very interesting. And it's interesting because Keir Starmer was the director of public prosecutions. He's as aware as anyone that in those 1,400 cases, there are many, many extenuating circumstances which have led judges to decide not to put people in prison. Could be that the person doing the assault is a minor, could be the person doing the assault has a learning difficulties. There could be any number of reasons why the judge has decided that it's not suitable to put someone in prison. So the fact that Keir Starmer is doing that and leaning in that way, signaling that he just wants to lock up more people, is part of Starmer's five pledges. And one of those is around establishing Labour as the party of law and order. And it's very sad. You know, as Stephen says, of course, it's naive of me to expect Labour to be more liberal than the Conservatives on this stuff. But I reached out to the Labour Secretary of State for Justice, tried to talk about some of the things we were doing, tried to encourage him to get back into that, because I was very frustrated by the sort of rightward lurch under the influence of Dominic Raab and Boris Johnson. And found, of course, that Labour was proposing to outmaneuver the Tories, be more ferocious on law and order than the Conservatives. And of course, now the Conservatives are fighting back. And you then have a real race for who can sound most ferocious about locking things up. I think the other thing, I mean, Stephen's absolutely right that we have to put victims at the centre of this. I mean, I don't think that it makes any sense to not acknowledge the horrible harm that many criminals cause in people's lives. And that could be the trauma of seeing your home violated. That could be the physical trauma of being assaulted on the street. And that's before you get on to rape and murder and many other things. So I think it's very important to say that there is a real place for prison. But it's also important to acknowledge that, you know, the prisoners that I dealt with came from generally a very, very small section of society. About a third of them had been excluded from school. More than a third of them had been in care, compared to about 2% of the population on those both indicators. Half of them had mental health issues. About half of them had addiction issues. And it's a difficult thing to balance. You have to balance your perception of the incredible pain and horror that many of the people in prison have caused in other people's lives and think about how you control that and deal with it, while also acknowledging that there is a very, very deep connection between people who've grown up in poverty and have been through brutal childhoods and the crimes they commit.
Mm. I mean, I suppose one of the issues is whether there is a way of acknowledging and responding to the needs and views of victims apart from simply longer and longer prison terms. I mean, that's certainly the approach that some of the media take. I mean, Stephen, this is an issue that politicians presumably are concerned about, how they are portrayed in the media. What role do you think the media does play in this?
I think the impact of the media on politics is always a bit of a chicken and egg situation. What comes first? Guardian readers being more liberal, The Guardian covering a parole hearing without mentioning what the crime in question was, because they know that what their readers want is a, you know, this 60-something person probably should be let out at this point story. Well, it's both, right?
Just to confirm, Stephen, you're here talking about Charles Bronson, who spent 48 years in prison for armed robbery and other crimes, and was recently denied parole.
Yeah, that is exactly right. So what comes first? What the Mail says online and what people see in their own community, what they click on Facebook or what they pick up on the newsstand? Well, it all reinforces each other. On my own estate, when someone does get an ASBO, people can see that for 12 months, the estate becomes a model community again. It's why I do think the political position where Rory and David Gawk landed, essentially of, yes, there will be fewer people in prison, but most of them will be there for longer, is the right way through the public opinion challenges, partly because I think it is what the thankfully decreasing number of people who are the victims of violent crime want to.
To be fair, I think, to Rory and David Gawk's record, I don't think they ever said that people in general should be in prison for longer. They kind of did a dance of messaging, but I don't think they said that, unlike kind of exactly what's being said at the moment.
Well, to square the circle between the two of you, we didn't increase the length of prison sentences, but what we did say in order to justify getting rid of short sentences is that the only hope of actually doing rehabilitation is to have people in for longer. You can't work with people if they're only in for 10 or 20 days, and that actually what it really does is disrupt their lives and make them more likely to reoffend. And I think we also wanted to emphasize that there were people who really did deserve to be in prison and who for public protection should be kept in prison. So I think you're right, we didn't extend sentence length, nor would we have wanted to. But Stephen's also right that it was very important in terms of our public communication that we were signaling strongly that we believe that prison worked for some people. I mean, it's a very odd world, this, as you can imagine, as a politician, because on the one hand, you know, I have ferocious colleagues attacking me on the backbenches in debates in Parliament, saying that we're being soft on crime. On the other hand, I go to the US and the Consul General in New York organizes to get US criminologists together with me, and everybody in that room is essentially saying they want to abolish prison. So there's an extraordinary universe between the sort of far liberal progressives who really don't want to talk about prison at all, and the right that want to be more ferocious. And I think one of the challenges for a practical working politician is to try to not fall into the trap of endorsing full liberal idealism. You have to remain, I think, in my case as prisons minister, continue to believe that there is a place for prisons and some people should be in prison.
Okay, I think perhaps that's a note at which we sadly have to draw things to a close. Before we do that, can I ask each of you, if you were in a position to make one change to try to reverse the punitive tide of policy in this area, what would that be? Stephen?
So I think actually it would be giving governors far greater control over what happens on their own prison estates. I think Michael Gove was absolutely right to identify that as the most effective single lever a politician can pull, pulling it away from I am the person who has to stand up in the House of Commons and continually be barracked from my backbenches position. Now, if I were Secretary of State for an indefinite period, there were many other things I would do. But in terms of the one lever, that actually is maybe the one change I'd make.
And you, Rory?
Well, punitive tide, I think, would be leaning much more strongly into abolishing short sentences and making sure that you're serious about that and pushing out towards 12 months, 2 years. I think that the single change that I would introduce if I had the power to do so is much clearer minimum standards. So I would make it illegal to crowd a prison and force the problem back on the government if they start locking up more people than they can accommodate, really force them to build more prisons.
But then they're going to ship them off to another country, Rory.
They might try to do that, but the costs would mount very, very considerably. I think if people understood that the cost of putting 85,000 people into prisons built for 65,000 is the Treasury being stuck with billions of pounds of extra spending, we would see governments focusing much more. The Treasury is very powerful. You know, it's a very, very powerful ally for any government. And if the Treasury begins to think that billions of pounds is being removed from health spending, education spending, because people are playing public opinion on locking people up for longer, that's a really useful thing. And actually, it's also the only way of doing what Stephen and Michael Gove want to do, which is to give more power to governors. You can only give more power to governors if you set very, very clear minimum standards. Autonomy for governors cannot be the governor does whatever the hell they like, including overcrowding prisons, not focusing on violence, repainting the wall colour or doing whatever jolliness they want to do. It's got to be a very clear framework in which their autonomy operates. And minimum standards, I think, is part of that.
Rob, what about you? What one thing would you do to reverse the punitive tide?
Well, I've long been interested in trying to find some way of taking the politics out of this, in the same way that the interest rates are decided by the Monetary Policy Committee, not by politicians. Is there some mechanism? The sentencing council could have been it that decides the length of sentences rather than politicians.
Thanks, Rob, Stephen and Rory. And if you'd like to hear the Rory Stewart Longford lecture on this subject, you can listen to it online on or after November the 22nd. And other resources mentioned in the programme will be in our programme notes. Thanks and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye from me.
Goodbye.